Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Kia ora, g'day and welcome to the History of Aotearoa New Zealand, episode 127, Q&A 2023, part toru. This podcast is recorded in Te Whanganui Atara on the rohe of Muiupoko, Taranaki Whānui, Te Atiawa and Ngāti Toa Rangatira. We are generously supported by our amazing patrons. If you want to support Hans, go to patreon.com/historyaotearoa. Let's crack into it. The first question I have got here is from Waffles, who does the podcast Waffles and Mates Talk About Things. Waffles is really cool. I've met them in person because they are a New Zealand podcaster as well, and Waffles has actually DM'd for me a few times in various capacities playing Dungeons and Dragons, so that's pretty cool as well. So I know Waffles, I guess, reasonably well, because the New Zealand podcast community is quite small, as you probably might expect. But Waffles and Mates Talk About Things is an improvisational podcast, comedy podcast, which is really, really funny, you know, just improvising all sorts of random shit for all sorts of different things. It's really, really good. I highly recommend it. It is very funny. It's very Kiwi humor, I guess, is what I might describe it as. So if that's kind of your vibe, then please do go and check it out. So thank you, Waffles, for these three questions, actually, that you gave me. The first being, what's one thing that's been lost to history that you'd love to rediscover? Now, I have, I guess, a few different answers for this. One that I'm kind of interested in is, where is Alexander the Great's tomb? I think that's a really weird and kind of interesting thing that we don't know where that is, and maybe it never existed, but like the story around it is kind of compelling and all that sort of stuff. But I think the really big one for me is around music and games, because for a lot of ancient music, I'm talking like pre-classical period, so, you know, sort of Iron Age or Bronze Age, I guess, sort of period. So pre-Roman, you know, Mesopotamia, that kind of stuff. For a lot of music around that time, we have the lyrics, but we often don't have the melody of how a song was played. Sometimes we might have the instruments that would have likely been used, and sometimes we don't, but usually we don't exactly know how these instruments were tuned or in what manner they were played or how they accompanied any singing. There's just a lot of different variables and unknowns around how these pieces were composed and likely played for an audience. And we're unlikely to learn how these songs were sung. It's, as you say, something that's kind of just lost to history because we don't have records of these things. And, you know, obviously we can't pick up a USB stick, for example, that's got an ancient song on it because that didn't exist back then. So it's hard to convey songs on, even on written like paper or clay tablets or anything like that. So again, we're unlikely to learn how these songs were sung, But I think, you know, music is an intrinsic part of the human experience. So it's a bit sad that we'll never get to hear those songs. And I think it would be really interesting if we could hear them again in their original format. It's music, I think most people will agree, is something that kind of transcends time and space and that sort of thing. So, yeah, there's something quite, you know, obviously emotional, but also kind of, I don't want to say primal. Primal's not really the correct term, but there's something about particularly music that's very old. And I'm not talking like from like the Beatles from the 60s or some shit. I'm talking, yeah, again, I'm talking about like stuff that's like thousands of years old. There's something about it, knowing that people listened to that music thousands of years ago, that's quite indescribable. You can't really quite describe that feeling of knowing that the music you're listening to was listened to people thousands of years ago. It's just so good. In a similar vein with games, I really like playing board games. I'm a big board games nerd. I recently bought a copy of Mutorere, which I found in a shop here in Wellington, which I was really chuffed with because I've never found a commercial version of that game. So that was really cool. So I really like playing board games, and you know, as such, I find it really interesting when game pieces are found in archaeological sites. Sometimes we'll find little chess pieces or counters or colored rocks or, you know, various whole difference of things. Game boards are a lot rarer, but sometimes you'll find game boards as well. But any of that sort of stuff I find really interesting. There's a really cool die, like a die that you roll, a six-sided die from sometime during the Roman Empire. I'm not quite sure of the year or the century specifically, but you know, it's roughly about 2,000 years old, this six-sided die, and the dots on it are in the same configuration as the six-sided die that you'll see today. You know, the five is in that sort of cross-shaped pattern. The six is in the three-dot parallel lines. You know, that sort of thing. And I genuinely thought, when I saw this originally, I genuinely thought that that meant it was fake. But I found through... Actually, I saw this on Twitter, so it was Fake History Hunter on Twitter, which is a great Twitter account if you're on there. Highly recommend following them. She actually posted a source that indicated that this was actually real, and that configuration, the dots and where they are on the die, is actually 2,000 years old, and we still use that today, which I think is amazing, brilliant. So interesting. Kind of a shame that most of the D6s that you'll get from, you know, D&D shops and stuff actually show the Arabic numeral on the die instead of this configuration, because, again, that's just so interesting. I just think that's great. But just like with the music, when these game pieces are found, or these game boards, they're usually not whole. You know, these pieces missing, the board itself is probably broken in some way. You know, these have been, you know, in dirt or sand or wherever else for possibly thousands of years. And so we don't usually know how these games kind of came together, how these games were played. And of course, it would be fascinating to know how these games, you know, how they played and what the strategies were and all that sort of stuff. But of course, that's unlikely due to the passage of time. Same with music. And because of that, I think we are really lucky that we know how some of the historical games were played. The three that jump to mind are obviously Mutorere. We talked about that in previous episodes. It's an ancient Māori game. We also know how Hneflteffel, the Viking sort of chess, it's sometimes called. We know how to play that. I've got a copy of that in my house as well, which my partner made for me, which was very nice. And the Royal Game of Ur is probably the other really famous one as well, which was discovered by one of the guys at the British Museum, whose name escapes me. But Tom Scott did a video on that a few years ago, if we've got any Tom Scott fans in the audience. And as I said, I've got a copy of both Hnefeltafl and Mutorere in my house now. And it's always amazing to be able to play them, knowing that people played that exact same game, or more or less that exact same game, for fun, hundreds and possibly even thousands of years ago. And just kind of in general, I think recreation and fun is something that's a bit underappreciated sometimes as a subject of historical interest for the wider public. Obviously, there's historians that specialize in that sort of area, but I think for the general public, it's often not something that's on their radar that they think about when they think of cool things to learn from history. You know, usually they're thinking about, you know, kings and battles, warriors, politics, and all that kind of stuff. But I personally find subjects like what people would do in their off time, what music did they listen to, what games did they play, what stories did they tell each other, what kind of gossip were they discussing? I find that kind of stuff really interesting, because that's what I live for. I guess some people, you know, live for their work, and obviously how people worked in history is obviously really interesting as well, but the stuff you do for fun, that's the stuff that people generally live for. That's the stuff that they were enjoying. They weren't doing that because they had to. They weren't doing that because it was key to their survival. They were doing it because they thought it was fun and it brought them enjoyment. And that's very human, and that really, I think, connects me to the past in a way. I don't know. I just think music, games, people, things that people were doing for recreation, I just think that's really interesting, which is, I mean, that's what all of this is, right? But I just think there is something very compelling. There is something about music and games and recreation. I'm not even into that much into music, modern music, like in my day to day. I'm not really a big music person, and I don't know bands, and I don't go to concerts. But something about historical music and historical games really just speaks to my soul in a way that other things don't, you know. You might not, but that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. All right, the second question from Waffles. What has been the most surprising thing you've learned from the pod? And I thought a lot about this, and the slightly cop-out answer is that, you know, people actually listen to it. The thing that every podcaster says is, wow, I'm really surprised anyone listens to me. But I'm going to go against the grain here and not say that, because if I'm being totally honest, I knew that people would listen to this podcast, because I was pretty certain there were people out there like me who had minimal New Zealand history education in school, wanted to know more, and also happened to listen to other history podcasts. I didn't think that would be a small demographic. I made this podcast in the sense that I still make it this way this is something I would listen to. If somebody else was making this is something I would listen to. And that's kind of my benchmark, is if I make an episode and I can listen back to it, and I find myself doing this kind of frequently, is I'll go back to an episode, listen to it, just because, I don't know, just to kind of see if I've made any improvements over time. And I'll find myself not analyzing it, but instead just listening to the content. And at that point, I know, this is good. I'm happy with this. I think this is good, because if I'm listening to it just out of enjoyment, and I researched and wrote the fucking thing and recorded it, and I'm still going like lost in listening to the information, then I reckon I'm onto a winner, you know? So I know you know, in New Zealand we have tall poppy syndrome, and you're kind of meant to be a little bit humble, and it sounds really up myself to say I knew people would listen to this, but it's true. I knew people would listen to this. Well, I was like pretty sure that there would be people like me and that there was a gap in the market, if you will, for this. So yeah, so that's the cop-out answer, which I'm, again, not going to say that I'm surprised people listen to the podcast. The real answer to this is twofold, I guess. One is that probably the most surprising thing is the doors you can open just by sending an email and having a nice title or a bit of an audience. You know, just, you see something cool that you want to talk about with someone, you know, who's like quite official, and you just flick them an email and just be like, hey man, this is who I am, this is what I do, would you like to come and talk about this thing with me? Usually they say yes. And that's actually the way that I get most of my interviews, is just basically just cold emailing people. For example, the way that I got the Rongoā Māori interview with Donna Kerridge was because I saw an RNZ article talking about the Therapeutic Products Control Bill, or whatever that was called. And she was mentioned in it. She was the person that they'd asked questions about it. So I took that article, Googled her name, found her website, read a bit about her, and had a contact form on that website. So I flicked her an email and said, hey, this is who I am. I've seen this article and stuff about you. Would you like to come and talk to me? And she emailed back. It was actually like 8 p.m. at night, and she emailed me back like really quickly, which I was very surprised by. And she said, hey, that'd be awesome. When do you want to set that up? Which was fucking great. That was amazing. And she was super nice. All of the people that I interview are super nice. Just by sheer virtue of the fact that they actually want to come and talk to me is already like a really good start. That they want to take time out of their day to come and talk to me and share that knowledge, not with just with me, but with all of you as well. So that's how I got that one. And the Biscuit Tin interview from a few years back, where you know, we went and talked about the biscuit tin that's used in the members' bill selection process in Parliament to this day, I just DM'd the parliamentary Twitter account. I just DM'd them on Twitter. You know, the Parliament's got a social media account on Twitter, and they post about, you know, what's going on in Parliament today, which is totally neutral. It's non-political. They're just saying, this is the bill that we're debating today, or this is the ceremony that's going on today. So it doesn't involve any like MPs or taking sides or anything. So I DM'd that account and said, hey, again, this is who I am, this is what I do, could I come and talk about the biscuit tin? And they said, sure. Is there anyone in particular that you'd like to talk to? And I said, well, not really. You know, I don't have anyone in particular in mind, just someone who is knowledgeable about the biscuit tin that would be able to answer my questions, basically. And they went away and came back and said, sure, would you like to come and talk to the Clerk of the House, who is like a really quite highly ranked person in Parliament? And yeah, so I was like, hell yeah. So I did. I went into their big fancy building and interviewed the Clerk of the House, which was great. And so yeah, all of the interviews that I get are pretty much, yeah, just cold emailing them, and they're just very nice people who say yes and yeah, take the time out of their day to come and talk to me, which is amazing. And I'm ever so thankful that they do that, because I'm just some guy. Because I guess the other side of that is, I say that most people say yes. Most people who email me back say yes. I've had a number of emails that just go unanswered, and that's fine. All well and good, you know, that if they don't want to talk to me, absolutely fine. As I said, I'm just some guy. So if they don't want to talk to me, that's totally okay. And you know, I have emailed people and they just don't get back to me. But of the people that do get back to me, pretty much everyone says yes, which is great and amazing. And I love that. But it was very surprising, in the sense that I thought I'd have to jump through a bunch of hoops to go talk to various people. You know, if I'm just emailing a person, then, you know, sometimes, you know, you wouldn't expect there to be too many hoops to jump through. It's just the person setting up a time and all that sort of stuff. But for people like, again, the Clerk of the House or the manager of the repatriation team at Te Papa, I thought, right, I'm going to have to sign all these documents and talk to all these people, especially with Parliament. You know, I had to go through security and stuff. I made a fucking fool of myself, but I, you know, to go onto the actual physical site, you have to have there's a bit of paperwork involved. Not much, but I thought I'd have to jump through all these different hoops, because these are very important people with very important jobs and they're very busy. And they just, I just didn't. They just say, right, yeah, here's the time, here's the day, show up. And I'd go, great. So yeah, so that was very surprising, is that it's very easy to get these people to come and talk to me, because usually, I guess part of it is usually I'm targeting, sounds a bit, maybe a bit aggressive, but usually the people that I'm asking to come on are people that are very passionate about what they do. And just the opportunity to get to talk about these things is, they light that up. They're like, yes. In terms of, though, something that is history specific, I think what always surprises me is how relatable the people of the past are, which kind of goes back a little bit to what I was talking about with the games and the music in the previous question, just generally in my interest in human recreation. Because, again, it's kind of cool to know that a 1,000-year-old game that my ancestors may have enjoyed also brings me joy to play today. It's just, it's a human connection. It's a thing that transcends time and space as well. Because, of course, my ancestors are from, not from New Zealand or Aotearoa. They're from primarily England. Kind of, I guess, even more specifically in my research into pre-European Māori, there wasn't a specific aspect that really struck me as relatable. But there was lots of little things that I was like, yeah, I feel that. I understand that. And one I remember in particular was someone who was wanting to avenge the death of their family member. And kind of as part of the rhetoric he was putting out there was, as a threat, he said he would be like the toitoi, which, if you're not from New Zealand, is a bush that has very sharp leaves that give you lots of like little paper cuts if you aren't careful. And I just thought that was so relatable, because I've been cut from toitoi, and it really fucking hurts. And so for this guy to be like, I'm gonna be like this razor sharp grass and become your worst nightmare, I just thought that that was a great line. I just thought that was so interesting, and I got immediately what he was getting at. And so it was stuff like that, even though that person isn't, you know, he's not my ancestor, and there's absolutely no way he could be my ancestor. But because I live in Aotearoa and a lot of the plants and animals I have been around all my life also existed in the time of pre-European Māori, it gave this sense of relatability and connectedness. Of like, although I don't have the experience of having to avenge the death of a family member, I kind of get where this guy is coming from, because I know what toitoi is and have been cut by it before. So just, I guess it's, in terms of, yeah, pre-European Māori, it's an environmental relatedness to kind of know that, yeah, the plants and animals and the, not necessarily the climate, I guess, too much, but like just the environment that they were in is relatively similar, at least in terms of, again, yeah, plants and animals, is relatively similar to what I grew up in. The kind of birds that I see now are the same sort of birds that they would have seen as well. So, yeah, there's an environmental relatedness there that I find. That's how I found that connection. And I thought that that was very surprising as well. I hadn't expected to feel that connected to Māori in that sort of way. Because, again, my ancestry is from somewhere else. And so, yeah, I just found that kind of interesting that, yeah, even though people back then, the society was so different to what it is now, there was still some level of relatability there that I was like, yeah, I get where you're coming from when it comes to toitoi, and it really hurts, and why you'd want to indicate that you're going to be toitoi because it really hurts and you're wanting to be avenging this family member. So I thought that was kind of surprising. All right, Waffles' final question. Where do you see the future of NZ history going? Which I thought was kind of a funny question, because being like, where do you see the future of the past going? I thought was funny. But I get what you're asking. I get what you're saying. So I think it's going to get better. That's my hope. anyway, especially in the sense that schools are now teaching more New Zealand history than they have ever before, which is obviously a good thing. Back when I was at high school, sort of approximately 10-ish years ago now, I was taught basically no New Zealand history, pretty much other than the treaty, Te Tiriti o Waitangi. And even then, it was not great. So the fact that they're teaching a much wider range of New Zealand history is obviously much better. The fact that they are talking about, you know, the New Zealand Wars and the colonization of New Zealand and anything that's basically not World War II as well. And I think there's also a bit of pre-European stuff in there as well. The fact that they're covering a lot wider range of different things and different topics is obviously better, because that wasn't what was happening in the past. I'm not familiar with the specifics of what is or is not being taught, but assuming it isn't things like the Moriori myth, and again, it isn't just Te Tiriti, I think that's a big improvement already. So hopefully, in the next few decades, we will see a lot more young people being more informed about our history and how we got to where we are today. Over the last sort of 5 to 10 years, there definitely has been a lot more interest in our history than previously. So I hope that continues as well. Not just because that might mean I get some more listeners, although that would be a great side effect, but I think it is good for everyone to have at least a basic understanding of their country's history and some of the main events that shaped it. In our case, that Te Tiriti o Waitangi is obviously a big part of that, but the New Zealand Wars are also a big part of that. And the arrival of Europeans and how Europe colonised New Zealand and why and how they went about it, all of that's very important. And of course, lots of different things in the 20th century as well. Springbok Tour, nuclear free movement, the World Wars are obviously a big one as well. But having a basic understanding is, I think, pretty essential and pretty good. What's also really important is that we're having a lot of conversations now that haven't been had in the past. Like, should we really have statues of Captain Cook when he probably wasn't a great guy? And at least a significant portion of the New Zealand population views him in a extremely negative light because of what he did to Māori. You know, he killed a bunch of Māori when he came here and sailed around and that sort of stuff, which was in the Gisborne area. And so a lot of people don't view him as a super great guy. Should we be venerating him through statues? That's a good conversation to have. So although they're difficult conversations to have, and of course there are a bunch of people that are not having those conversations in good faith, I hope we keep having them, that we keep re-evaluating our past and thinking critically about the things we decide to glorify, especially in the context of colonization, especially in the context that a significant portion of New Zealand's population has had a very different experience to the European population here in New Zealand. The Māori experience has been very different over the last 200 years than the Pākehā experience. So, you know, we need to keep that in mind when we're talking about these things, and, you know, it helps in understanding why certain people might feel extremely differently about some of these things that we've just taken for granted. Again, statues of people that were really bad people. So that I think is, those conversations are good. They are good to have. They're not always nice, but we need to have them. So I think that's good. I did tell a slight lie. Actually, Waffles has got one last question. This is, I guess, a quick one. What's one question you were hoping to get asked so you'd have an excuse to talk about it? There was two questions I was hoping to get asked, and both of them got asked, which was great, which was questions about my tech setup, because I've recently upgraded it, so I'd love to talk about it, and also questions around my sources, because it's not something that people have asked me in the past, I guess, and I do bring up the sources sort of relatively often, but it is something that I guess I did kind of want to talk about anyway, because sources are important. It's good for you guys to at least be somewhat familiar of where I'm drawing this information from, and I guess how I take that information and turn that into something that you can listen to, because there's a lot of shit in that stuff. So those were the two questions that I was hoping to get asked. All right, I've got a few questions from Jester Kiwi. Thank you for these questions, Jester Kiwi. He says, where did your love of history come from, and why in particular the Māori aspect? So to answer the first question, or part, the first part of your question, where did my love of history come from? I've kind of always been interested in history in some form or another. It wasn't until I got into high school that I really started kind of pursuing it more as an interest. It was just, you know, before then it was just something that kind of came up, and every time it came up I was like, man, I'm really into this. But it wasn't until I got to choose it as a subject in my final 3 years of high school that I was like, yeah, I'm like really into this, like I'd like to do something with this, or I, you know, I want to learn more about this. So like back when I was in primary school, I remember we did a project on ancient Egyptians, and I was really interested in that, learning about, you know, the pyramids and the pharaohs and Egyptian gods and all that sort of stuff, obviously at a primary school level. And I remember thinking that was great. And there's a specific instance, I'm not sure if I've talked about this on here before, but I remember there was a specific instance where one of the teachers had a friend or something that was from Egypt, or he lived in Egypt, and for whatever reason he had come over to New Zealand for a holiday or some work thing or whatever. However this ended up happening, one of the teachers was in contact with an Egyptian guy who was in New Zealand currently, and somehow convinced him to stand in front of 30-something, like 9-year-olds, and answer questions on Egypt, which at the time I thought was really interesting and really cool. This is a real Egyptian man. This is amazing. So we're asking him all these questions, and he's trying to reply, because he did, his grasp of English was not super great, which was fine, you know, to be expected. But yeah, so we're asking him all of these questions, and he's doing his best to answer them, and that was great. And it wasn't until years later that I realized, not necessarily how fucked up it was, but how this guy must have felt when he realized what he'd gotten himself into, because of course, Egypt has had hundreds, thousands of years of history post-ancient Egypt, you know? It's now a Muslim, primarily Muslim country. They speak Arabic, all that sort of stuff. So here's this probably Muslim Arab man standing in front of us, and all of us 8- or 9-year-olds have just been learning about ancient Egyptians. So when the teacher gets this person up in front of us and says, this is a real life man from Egypt, we naturally assumed that this man was an ancient Egyptian, or that his culture reflected what we'd been learning in class, which was ancient Egypt. So of course we're asking him all about these questions about ancient Egypt and like Ra and Horus and pyramids and pharaohs and whatever else. And I don't remember any like specific question or any specific answer he gave, but that was definitely the vibe of the questions that we were giving. And yeah, it wasn't until years later that I realized this guy probably didn't know a lot of that stuff, because why would you? Maybe he was a history major, I don't remember. But I don't think that was the case, because I distinctly remember his face being one of confusion and maybe fear. So I'm very sorry, anonymous Egyptian man that came to Invercargill in the early 2000s. You didn't deserve that. I hope I'm misinterpreting that situation. But if I'm not, I'm very sorry that that happened to you. But I have very fond memories of it many years later. So thanks. But yeah, so that was a really interesting one that I had early in primary school. And then when I got to high school, when I got to year 11, which is roughly 16 years old, I ended up doing history as a chosen subject. You know, when you get to a certain age in high school, you get to be able to choose your subjects. And I chose history, which sort of happened by accident. I was trying to do ICT. You know, when you go down and you choose what subjects you want to do, you have to consider the timing of when those classes are on. And so I wanted to do ICT, which is like computers and stuff. and that didn't work because I also had to do like some other, you know, I had to do like maths and English and stuff. And so when I'd done all the subjects I chose, ICT couldn't fit. And the only things that could were either metalworking or history. And I sure as shit wasn't going to do metalworking because that's, I'm not good at that sort of thing. So I sort of accidentally ended up in history. Yeah, which my mum, I've definitely said this before, which my mum didn't think I'd like because mum hated it when she was at school. Which was interesting because I went to the same school as my mum. And so because of that, and because the history teacher was there for so long, the history teacher I got was the same one that my mum had, which was hilarious. So yeah, and he was very passionate, extremely passionate. You know, if it wasn't for him, if you had to choose one person, where did my love of history come from? If you had to choose one person, he's probably pretty high on the list. If he's not number one, he's probably number two. His influence on the fact that I even pursued history any more than just a thing that I did at high school, because I didn't do it at university. I went into you know, zoology when I went to university. I went to do science. But the fact that I even considered doing, listening to history podcasts or reading about history in my free time, or even starting this podcast at all, ultimately the foundation, the bedrock that all of that is built on, is those 3 years of his class. Really. And so, yeah, his influence is, yeah, is the big one, I guess, really. And there was a really, it was really funny, actually, because I remember very early on in that class, it was one of the first few classes that we did. The first topic that we did was the Irish independence movement, you know, how Ireland got independence. And so one of the first classes was kind of about the British Empire and its makeup and, you know, kind of setting the scene for why Ireland wanted independence, which of course involved the British Empire. And one of the questions that he said, he asked the class, was what was the country or the place that they considered or that they called the jewel in their crown? And there was just this weird moment where no one was saying anything because no one knew the answer. But I had this weird thing in the back of my mind where I was like, pretty sure it's India, and I don't know why I know that. So I put my hand up and I said, yep, it's India. And teacher goes, yeah, you're right, it is. And so that was great. Felt pretty good about myself. And then after class had finished, he pulled me aside and he asked me, how'd you know that? And I said, I don't know, I just did. I don't know, I read it somewhere or something. And so that was kind of, I guess, the day that I kind of realized, I'm actually interested in this. And apparently some of this information gets retained. I also remember a time in primary school where a teacher asked a question, who was the monarch of England during some late 19th century event? And I was just like, I don't know, put my hand up and I went, Queen Victoria, because I knew Queen Victoria had reigned the longest out of all of the English monarchs. I thought, yeah, I mean, hedge my bets. If she reigned the longest, then yeah, she's probably, you know, there's probably a good chance it was her. And she goes, yeah, you're right, it was Queen Victoria. And then she says to the teacher aide, yeah, Thomas is really good at remembering dates. And at the time I remember thinking, no, that's not right. I just picked the one that I knew she, you know, she ruled the longest. So I was just, again, hedging my bets. But yeah, again, later I realized, yeah, I am kind of good at remembering dates. So, you know, she was right in the end. So that's, yeah, so that's kind of, I guess, a brief history of where my interest and enjoyment of history comes from. As to the second part of your question, why in particular the Māori aspect, that isn't necessarily, I mean, I obviously am very interested in the Māori aspect of New Zealand's history. And part of that is because I am not Māori, and so it's a different culture. Different cultures are interesting, regardless of whether it's Māori or an Asian culture or a European culture, like French or German or whatever. Different cultures are just inherently interesting. It's also interesting, of course, because I live here. It's a culture that is directly related to me and that I am at least somewhat immersed in terms of, like, I see Te Reo Māori all the time around the place on signs and things. Hear it on the telly. The news anchors say kia ora when they start their news briefing. So, you know, it's a culture that I'm vaguely familiar with at the very least. And so I find, you know, that it has some sort of relevance to me, I guess is what I'm getting at there. But I guess what I'm trying to sort of get at is I wonder, because I've been asked these sorts of questions before, like why in particular are you interested in Māori culture and history? And I get the odd feeling it stems from a misunderstanding of why I have structured the podcast in the way that I have, in that I've been talking pretty much exclusively about pre-European Māori culture. And it's not necessarily because I'm really interested in that, and so I was like, I really want to research that and look into that. That is obviously an element. I'm not denying it. I'm not being like, I hate all of that stuff and I'm really glad it's gone. That's not true. What I'm saying that's obviously an element, but I suspect it stems... There's perhaps people who ask me this question, I think, misunderstand that the position I come from when I structured the podcast in that I wanted to talk about pre-European Māori culture is that I did it primarily because I felt it was the right thing to do. Because I felt that there was no other way that you could talk about New Zealand history without starting with pre-European Māori. At the very least, you need to do that to understand why Māori were reacting, interacting, the way that they were interacting with Europeans. You need to understand the culture that they were coming from to understand why they were acting in that manner, at the very least. So that's why I did it, because you need to do that to understand why they were doing the things that they were doing. And also it's the right thing to do because obviously Māori are a huge part of New Zealand. They're the original people, the indigenous population of New Zealand, of Aotearoa. So to ignore a huge chunk of their history is just, I was never going to do that. That was not something that I was going to do. So that's, yeah. So I hope I'm not misinterpreting that question, but I just, yeah, sometimes when I get questions like that, I sometimes wonder whether they're coming from a perspective that is different to mine, where doing the pre-European stuff was always, it was just, there was absolutely no way I wasn't going to do it. I was always going to do it. And it's coming from a place where those people think that I kind of felt like I had an option to do it, whereas I don't feel like I had an option to do it. And that's fine. I'm not saying like I got locked into this thing, but I felt like that if I'm going to do this, we have to do this right, and this is how we're going to do it right. So yeah, again, I apologize if I've misinterpreted that question. As I said, I still do have an interest in Māori culture and history because I think it's relevant to me. It's relevant to New Zealand. It's a different culture. Different cultures are just inherently interesting. I'm trying to read between the lines, I guess, a little bit there. So I hope I haven't offended you or anyway. Just, trying to understand the underlying reason for the question. Alrighty, the second question from Just a Kiwi. What influences and or mentors have you had on your chosen historical studies? So this, I guess, like many of these questions, is twofold. Primarily, it has been the history podcast community, at least in terms of like influences on my history podcasting career, I guess you could call it. So Robin from the History of Byzantium was a huge help in the early days. I sent him an email before I actually started the podcast with a bunch of questions, being like, this is my idea. This is how I think I'm going to approach it. What do you think? Is this good? Is this bad? Do you foresee any problems? You know, just some general questions. How did you find sources? You'd think that's actually kind of an obvious thing. Just go out and buy books. But at the time, I had no idea. Where do I find reputable sources? And he was very much kind enough to reply with answers, which was great. And that's really where everything kind of kicked off from there. And then in that same email, he also kindly offered to place an ad on his podcast once I reached about 10 or so episodes, which he didn't have to do and I didn't ask for. But that, again, that was very, very nice of him. And so when I did those 10 episodes, I emailed him back and said, hey, I'm at your I've hit your threshold. How do we do this? And so I put a little jingle of me talking about the podcast on his podcast, and that was really the point where I got a bunch of new listeners pretty much overnight, and that's where things really kicked off. So that was amazing. That was really nice of him, and I'm very appreciative of Robin for doing that. So he was a really big influence, very much in the early days, but also I still listen to the History of Byzantium, so still even today, very much an influence on what I do. Otherwise, apart from him, there's of course Mike Duncan of the History of Rome. He's the grandfather of all this. He's the reason that this subsection of history podcasting exists. So to not mention him would really be leaving out a key person. You ask any history podcast, he's on their list of people who influenced them. So he's a big one. And the other one was Jamie from the British History Podcast, who was the first history podcast I ever started listening to and got hooked pretty much immediately. His style of narration, his commitment to the integrity of the sources and interrogating those sources, and that kind of stuff really, really stuck with me, of how to approach history in a way that you're confident in what you're saying and also making it interesting, you know, really straddling that line of looking at those sources and deciding whether they're reliable or useful, and then taking a lot of those sometimes really boring sources and turning that into something that's interesting to listen to and is going to hold people's attention, which I think he's very, very good at that. All three of those are people that I listen to this day. So, yeah, very much influenced. And more broadly, the whole history podcast community is very nice and supportive, which is very, very cool. Obviously, that's very, very nice. It's always amazing that everyone in the community is very nice. They're very helpful. When I put out a question, I get a bunch of answers that are very helpful, which is amazing. It's always nice to have a bit of a community that is very supportive, that you can bounce ideas off, that you can swap promos with, and all that sort of stuff. Other people that understand the struggles you're going through, not just in podcasting in general, but also with sources and things, and trying to find things in different languages and all that stuff. Just things that people that can relate to the struggles you're going through is always really nice. In terms of New Zealand specific mentors, obviously there's my history teacher, which I mentioned previously, but the two that probably jump out at me, at least since I started the podcast, are William Ray and Andre Brett. William Ray being the voice and just generally one of the main people behind the Radio New Zealand show Black Sheep, which is all about the horrible people in New Zealand's history. And he's also one of the people who is on the History Aotearoa show. And Andre Brett is a professor at university in Perth, which I don't remember the actual university, but he's also written some books about New Zealand history, particularly the trains, like the rail network in New Zealand, and New Zealand's provinces and the kind of rise and fall of the provincial system.
Andre is also a doctor. He has a PhD. He's a smart man. And he is currently a lecturer, at least at time of recording, at Curtin University in Perth.
Now, these are two very different people, and it's not super obvious why I've picked those people, because what they did was in some ways very small and extremely simple, but for me was very impactful. All they really did was chat to me about history, the podcast, and all sorts of things over a drink. Both William and Andre I met in person, just kind of being like, let's go have a feed, go have a drink, and let's just chat because we have similar interests. Also because in Andre's case, because we're both on New Zealand Twitter, and Andre shitposts a lot and I really like it. So there was that as well. We knew each other through that. But it was really nice of them to come and talk to me in person. They both said nice things about what I was doing, which again is quite simple, but it really means a lot and really helps to energize me to do more. Andre was also very nice to sign my book. I bought one of his books and he signed it for me, which was very nice. And William is also working for RNZ, put in a few good words for me and resulted in me getting on the radio during the summer programming in the 2022-2023 period, which was very nice of him as well. He didn't have to do that. And the key kind of thing here is that podcasting on your own can sometimes be quite lonely if you don't have someone who's working on the podcast with you. You don't get a lot of feedback because people just listen to your episodes and then just think to themselves, wow, that was interesting, and then they move on. They don't tend to let you know that they enjoyed the episode, which is totally fine. I'm not blaming anyone for that. I do it too. It's okay. But it does mean that occasionally you wonder if you're doing the right things or if anyone is actually listening. I know the numbers are going up when I look and it says, yeah, 50 people listened to this today. But it's just numbers on a screen, you know? Getting that feedback from people who email me or at me on Twitter, and they're like, I thought this was really good. I listened to this. I learned this. That was interesting. You know, that tells me that real people are listening to it. Even though, you know, again, fundamentally, I know that those numbers all represent actual people listening to it. But it's different when you hear it from someone through an email or on Twitter or on Instagram or whatever. So yeah, so if you're not getting that sort of feedback, then it is, yeah, sometimes a bit harder to keep yourself going, to motivate yourself to keep going. Yeah, just if there's not that human interaction and that human connection, I guess. So to get a little bit of that encouragement, especially from people that you respect and that are in, you know, they're in that history industry, I guess. This is their job. Is doing history stuff. So, you know, to get that encouragement from the people that are doing similar-ish things to you, that encouragement is really amazing and is really fantastic. Not to say that encouragement from people who listen, it's not that I don't respect you. Obviously I respect you. But yeah, to get it from people that are sort of doing similar things to you means a lot, because then you kind of know you're on the right track. All right, the last question from Just a Kiwi is, as this subject is ever evolving, what directions are you considering in the future? This is actually very similar to another question that I got, so I am going to lump that in with that question and answer both of those questions at the same time, which is right now. So the next person we've got is John M. As I said, his question is very similar, but it does have a few extra bits tied to it. So John's question is, I listen to a few narrative history podcasts. Most focus on a specific society, civilization, culture, or nation. For example, Rome or China. But yours seems to be about the land of Aotearoa New Zealand itself, with both the Māori and later the European colonists being just one part of that history. Was that a deliberate choice on your part? Is it a reflection of your background as a conservationist? Do you think this focus will change as the narrative moves into the colonial period? All of these are very good questions, so thank you, John, for all three of those questions, and thank you, Just a Kiwi, for your questions as well. So there is certainly an element in the podcast of my background in conservation, such as the Bird of the Year episodes. Those are probably the most obvious influence of my background. And I do like to read and talk about the different plants and animals and how these fit into Māori culture. In the most basic sense, it's something that I'm interested in, so I like to include it in the podcast. It's likely I'm going to talk a lot about how the landscape changed when Europeans arrive, such as logging and draining wetlands or reclaiming land to expand cities. Taiō, Ngahere, Whenua is all stuff that I'm interested in, so it's present in the podcast because of that. However, I don't think that is the answer to your question. I don't think the reason that my focus is on the land of Aotearoa New Zealand is because I've got a conservation background. The conservation stuff is mostly just my particular flavour or brand or spin on the history. I think that just adds a nice little, you know, that's the sprinkles on top rather than whether I put the sprinkles on cake or ice cream, if you get what I mean, in that very poor metaphor. So was it a deliberate choice to make the land of Aotearoa New Zealand kind of the focal point of the podcast? Sort of is the answer to that question. It's a sort of deliberate choice. I didn't exactly consciously make it, but if I'm being totally honest, I don't see how else you would make a podcast or YouTube series or whatever about general New Zealand history without the central focal point being the whenua, being the actual land of Aotearoa New Zealand. Not necessarily talking about the land itself, but kind of being like, where is our focus? Where does our gaze sit? Our gaze sits around the land. Whatever's happening on the land, that's fine, but our gaze is sitting on the archipelago, is sitting on these islands. Reason being that New Zealand's history is fundamentally about various cultures meeting and clashing. Primarily Māori and the British, but there's also the Dutch, the French, the Americans, Dalmatians, other Polynesians, Chinese, and a whole host of others. You could certainly focus on one of those cultures, and that is worthwhile, but if the goal is to make something somewhat exhaustive that shows pretty much the whole picture, then just focusing on Māori or just focusing on the British isn't gonna get you to where you want to be. For example, I could have started with James Cook, but then you'd miss out on the pre-European Māori period and Abel Tasman. In addition to this, because New Zealand is a series of islands, that makes it pretty logical for the land to be the focal point. It has a very contained history because you know that everything happens in this one area. There is a hard border, which is the sea, unlike, say, China or Rome, where it wouldn't make sense to focus on just the Yellow River Valley or the Italian Peninsula. Those areas have changed drastically over time in terms of culture. And because they are part of wider narratives of the Chinese and Roman empires, it makes more sense to focus on the polity rather than the geography, if that kind of makes sense. For those histories, focusing on the cultures and how the cultures developed and expanded, contracted, influenced other cultures, focusing on that makes sense for them. I don't think it makes sense for a history on Aotearoa. It doesn't make sense to focus just on one culture or one aspect. We want to know what's happening in this particular area, this particular region that is the archipelago of Aotearoa. In saying that, to address Jester Kiwi's last question as well, the focus is going to change as we go forward. Obviously, the bulk of the action is going to take place in Aotearoa, but the European empires are a key part of that story, and so to tell that aspect, we do need to talk about at least some of what is going on outside of the archipelago. The story of Abel Tasman, for example, isn't really going to involve a lot of the actual landmass of Aotearoa at all, really. He was only here for like a week or something, so if we just focused on that week where he was physically here, it wouldn't be terribly interesting and you'd be missing a whole lot of context and a whole lot of interesting history that does kind of affect things down the line and does affect, yeah, it does generally affect kind of a lot of different things in very small ways. The stuff that's actually happening right here at the time is not necessarily the meat of that story. The meat is really in why he was here and what happened to him afterwards and how that information he got when he was here, how was that used in the future. So just talking about what's going on physically here is not going to make sense for that story. We need to talk about a lot of other stuff that's going on around it. And a lot of that other stuff is really interesting as well, even if it's not immediately solely focused on Aotearoa itself. There's also the aspect of lots of people have probably heard of Abel Tasman. Lots of people probably know that he's the first European to turn up in Aotearoa, but lots of people probably don't know who he is or why he came or what his motivations were in general, what kind of person he was like, all that sort of stuff. So it's also about taking this person who is, you know, most New Zealanders will kind of know who he is, or at least know his name and know the thing that he's most well known for, but they won't really know anything else about who he is. And so it's not just about talking about New Zealand's history, it's also about teaching you about this person you probably have heard of and demystifying him a bit. Then, once New Zealand gets a colonial government, it will start projecting its power into the Pacific, and as the world becomes more global, New Zealand will become more prominent on the world stage, both as a political entity and just its citizens in general. You know, New Zealanders end up leaving the country and doing all sorts of things across the globe. Edmund Hillary climbs Mount Everest. He's one of the first people to do so, along with Tenzing Norgay. And lots of New Zealanders served in RAF Bomber Command in World War II. And of course, New Zealand soldiers served all over the world in many capacities during both World Wars. Just talking about what happened in Aotearoa during that time would be leaving a lot of stories on the floor, as well as leaving a lot of context there as well. So to really boil the answer to your question down, yes, the focal points will change slightly to be more focused on particular characters and their influence on Aotearoa, and eventually somewhat more around the polity that is the nation-state of New Zealand when that arises in our story. Generally, that's how I like to tell stories, around a central sort of person or entity. You would have seen that with like the Barnett Burns episodes or the Spates episodes, the focus being around one sort of person or thing. So I hope that kind of makes sense. Again, I hope I've interpreted that question correctly. I found it a little bit difficult to get across what I was thinking, so I hope I'm picking up what you're putting down, and I hope it's going the reverse way as well. If you want to get in touch, my email and social media are on historyaotearoa.com. Aotearoa spelt Aotearoa. You can also find helpful resources there, like transcripts and sources. If you would like to support Hans, you can do so through donating via Patreon or giving us a review. As always, haere tū atu, oki tū mai. See you next time.